less crowded now, although there were still too many people around for her peace of mind. Priests, citizens, tourists, a dozen more hands of justice, walking around as though they owned the place. The handful of city guardsmen gave them a wide berth. Emily couldn't help wondering precisely what was going on behind the scenes. "Another statue," Frida said. She jabbed a finger towards the center of the road. "That wasn't there yesterday." Caleb nodded and led them to the statue, pushing his way through the crowds. Few people seemed to want to get too close, as if something about the statue spooked them. Emily studied it with some interest, reaching out with her senses in the hopes of touching whatever magic had been used to make it. But there was nothing, no wisp of magic at all. The only clue that the statue had once been human was its sheer perfection. No sculptor ever born could carve so much detail into stone. She reached out to touch it, but all she felt was cold stone. Marble? She wasn't sure. Screams split the air. Emily jumped back, expecting... She wasn't sure what she expected. She readied a spell, turning around to see the crowds moving back from the Temple of Justice. The screams grew louder. She glanced around, looking for a proper vantage point. Perhaps if she climbed up... The crowd parted. 7 people, 5 men, 2 women, knelt in front of the temple. Their shirts had been removed, leaving them topless. A hand of justice stood behind each of them, holding a nasty-looking whip. Emily watched in growing horror as they brought the whips down again and again, drawing blood as they lashed bare flesh. The victims screamed, then pleaded for mercy. She wasn't sure who or what they expected to answer. Emily reached for her magic, then stopped. She didn't know what to do. Could she help them? Should she help them? They were making no attempt to escape. Even the women, both bare-breasted, both barely older than Emily herself, weren't trying to hide themselves, let alone trying to run. Had they chosen to be whipped? She looked away, feeling sick. The sound echoed in her ears, the screams mingling with the crowd roaring after every stroke. Men and women cheered, mocking the victims as they suffered. Insults and catcalls echoed, followed by whistles and lewd suggestions. She recoiled, then forced herself to move. Caleb and Frida followed, pushing their way through the growing crowd. She couldn't help realizing that both of them seemed to take the punishment in stride. It was just part of their world. The screams faded slowly as they made their way down the street, but her ears still rang. "They would have offered themselves for punishment to balance the scales," Caleb said quietly. A dozen youngsters pushed past them, no doubt eager to see the whipping before it was over. Justice is about balancing the scales. Emily shook her head. She'd heard that argument before. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. Such punishment didn't really change anything. The scene she'd unwillingly witnessed was more about retribution than anything else, a grim reminder that anyone could face such a horrific punishment. She'd seen men and women in the stocks, or forced into slavery as payment for their crimes, but public whippings were worse. "It's sick," she said. "They chose it," Caleb said. "They thought it would provide balance." "My father said the same thing," Frida said. She shivered. He was always drunk at the time. Emily reached out and squeezed Frida's shoulder. Her friend rarely talked about her childhood, but Emily had seen the scars. Frida had been beaten savagely, time and time again, from an early age. She'd been lucky, very lucky, to be sold to a passing magician and taken away to Mountaintop. She'd certainly never shown any interest in going home. But if they chose to be whipped, she asked herself, is it wrong? Despite herself, she had no answer. Chapter 7. The Bank of Silence was an immense building, easily larger than most of the temples she'd seen as they made their way to Banker's Row. It was larger than every other bank on the street, with a longer line of customers waiting outside. And yet Marcus had hired more guards to patrol the walls and placed more complex wards around the building. He clearly expected trouble. The other bankers had hired guards of their own. "We'll be taking a look at the shops," Caleb told her. "Do you know how to find your way to Railway Street?" Emily shook her head. "I'll ask someone." She wished suddenly that she'd thought to bring the chat parchment with her. It was astonishing how much she'd grown to miss cell phones over the last few years. How had people coped in bygone days without their friends and family at the touch of a button? If I meet you in a couple of hours?
If you can't find us, just go back to the house, Caleb said. We'll come back eventually.
Try not to get into trouble, Emily said. She glanced at Frida. And don't get him into any trouble either.
Caleb rolled his eyes but said nothing. Frida smirked.
Emily watched them go, then turned and walked to the front door. A pair of armored guards eyed her with professional interest, their eyes lingering on her face rather than her chest. Emily couldn't help thinking they looked more like soldiers than most of the men she'd met during the war. And yet, there was a falseness around them that bothered her, an attitude that made her think they hadn't seen real combat. Sergeant Harkin had been crude, rude, and willing to do whatever it took to turn his students into combat sorcerers, but he'd been a man. He'd seen the elephant and survived. These men. She thought they'd never seen war. A clerk standing behind them studied her for a long moment.
Yes?
Inform the manager that Lady Emily wishes to speak to him, Emily said firmly. The clerk's eyes opened wide, and then escort me to the waiting room. The clerk stared at her.
I need to see some proof.
Emily reached out with her magic and brushed it against the wards. Marcus had keyed her into the outer defenses back when he started the bank, pointing out that she was one of his best customers. The clerk jumped, then turned and scurried into the bank. Emily followed him, pretending not to notice the guards hiding smiles. There must be no love lost between them and their social superior. Marcus must have been alerted by the wards, because he entered the waiting room while the clerk was still trying to offer her food, drink, or the latest broadsheets. Emily smiled as he dismissed the panicked man, then opened a hidden door and invited Emily to walk upstairs to his office. He was only 3 years older than Emily, but he held himself like an older man. She told herself that it probably wasn't surprising. He was, after all, the de facto head of the Bankers Guild. His office was large, easily 5 times the size of a bedroom at Whitehall. A marble desk sat in the middle, under a pair of giant glass windows. A small set of comfortable chairs and sofas sat in the corner. Emily had to smile when she saw the portrait of Melissa hanging over the fireplace. It was so accurate that Melissa had clearly sat for it not so long ago. A pair of maps, one showing Beneficence and the surrounding lands, the other showing the known world, dominated the other wall.
Emily, he said, motioning for her to take a seat. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Emily said sincerely. She'd always liked Marcus, more than she'd liked Melissa. I would have written ahead, but
I heard.
Marcus rang a little bell on his desk.
You've been to war.
A young, dark-haired woman materialized out of a side door and bowed. Like so many others, she looked to be mixed race, a combination of Chinese and Indian features. Her dress was professional, but surprisingly tight around her breasts. And yet, there was an innocence about her that Emily found a little amusing. She suspected, from the glint in the woman's eye, that she dressed that way, so she was always underestimated.
Kava, please, Marcus said.
He looked at Emily.
Would you like something to eat?
No, thank you, Emily said. She leaned back in her chair as the secretary returned, carrying a tray of mugs, a pot of kava, and a small collection of pastries. Her stomach rumbled as she saw them, reminding her that she hadn't eaten that much for breakfast. Perhaps she could take one or two, just to be sociable. Marcus wouldn't mind.
Help yourself.
Marcus sat down facing her, taking a mug and a single pastry.
I believe we all owe you a debt.
It came at a high cost, Emily said. Had Marcus known Casper?
He might well have known of him. Most magical children were taught the names and family lines of their peers.
But we won the war.
Yes, you did, Marcus said.
He leaned back in his chair.
Did you read the last stockholders' report?
Emily shook her head. It would have been sent out 3 weeks ago, but naturally her copy would have gone to Whitehall. Marcus wouldn't have known where else to send it. She'd find it when she returned to school. There were a lot of people coming in and out of the banks, she said instead. And the city feels odd.
There's been an investment boom.
Marcus tapped his nose meaningfully.
The microloans we've been offering, along with the other banks, have galvanized a massive boost in industry. Investment in steam engines and railways has skyrocketed. Everyone is buying stock. If they can afford it, Emily said. If they can afford it, Marcus agreed. He frowned, nodding towards a pile of letters on his desk. The requests for loans, more significant loans, are coming in day by day. My staff are more than a little overwhelmed. Emily frowned. How secure are these loans? Some are good, some are bad. His face darkened. I've earned a reputation for being stingy, I'm afraid. I won't loan money unless I think there's a better than even chance I'll recoup my investment. That's common sense, Emily pointed out. Not according to some of the newer broadsheets, Marcus said. They're insisting that I'm putting the brakes on the industrial boom by not providing money to fuel it. He sighed. It isn't that easy to judge prospects, he admitted. I can seize the property of someone who takes a loan if they are unable to pay it back, yet what do I do if they just don't have enough to compensate me for the loss? A client took the loan I gave him and bought a ship, then vanished when it became clear he'd never be able to keep the ship. She's probably been renamed and repainted by now, somewhere on the other side of the world. Emily nodded in grim agreement. There was no international system for tracking down criminals, let alone debtors. A man who reached the next country, perhaps even the next city, with enough untraceable goods could probably vanish, taking a new name and finding a new place. There wouldn't even be many problems in hiding an entire ship. It wasn't as if there was a giant list of every ship sailing the seas. And I don't want to snatch their children, Marcus added. Melissa would kill me. Good for her, Emily said. The concept of taking someone's children to pay their debts was horrifying, even though it was technically legal. Melissa, who'd been used as a pawn herself in her family's affairs, had good reason to hate the practice. How are you coping? I've hired extra staff to research business opportunities, Marcus said. We do have a slush fund, and money coming in from most of the microloans, so we should be safe enough as long as we don't start cutting into our seed monies. It means we get some bad press, but most of our larger investments have managed to pay off. So the bank itself is fairly stable, Emily said. I think so, Marcus said. He took a sip of his kava. We can't control what people do when they remove their money. There have been times over the past few weeks when I've been worried about the sheer number of people trying to invest. I've even noted a number of customers who have taken the financial hit just to get their money out of the bank. They gave up a sure thing just to play the investment game. And if they lose, they lose, Emily said. Yeah. Marcus glanced at the window. And I'm really not sure what's happening with the other banks. The Bankers Guild isn't big on sharing information. I thought you were the guildmaster, Emily said. Only by courtesy, Marcus said. He grinned. I was the first bank manager in the city. Unless you count the handful of sorcerers who used to run Protective Vault. Some of them think they should have the title, to be fair. With or without them, Emily, we bankers don't have an established guild structure. I imagine one will sort itself out sooner or later, but it may not be in place when we need it. His expression darkened. And without some limited information sharing, he added, it's hard to know just how well the other banks are coping. Emily nodded. I thought that a number of banks did fail. Seven did, Marcus said. Five of them folded very quickly. I believe the original investors didn't realize they had to offer incentives beyond basic security. They had a few customers and collapsed when they couldn't repay the original investment. The sixth had a major break-in a couple of months after it opened. Their customers lost a great deal of gold, which led them to simply abandon the bank completely. Unsurprising, Emily commented. And the seventh? I don't know what happened to it, Marcus admitted. His face twisted in annoyance. He'd always liked to know things. One day everything seemed to be fine, the next the doors were shuttered, and the bank manager had done a runner. Thankfully, there weren't that many customers who lost out. I think the manager realized he couldn't repay his original investors and vanished, taking everything he could carry with him. It sounds likely, Emily agreed. We may never know for sure, Marcus said. The investors stripped the building, then sold it to Vesperian for a song.
I keep hearing that name, Emily said. Who is he?
The Railway King, Marcus said. Vesperian Industries built the Beneficence Cockatrice Railway, as well as a number of prototype steamboats and improved steam engines. They're currently plowing their profits into the planned Beneficence Zangaria Railway, or Vesperian's Track, as they call it. There's been a lot of investment in the line.
Emily lifted her eyebrows. She'd approved the original plans for the railway 2 years ago, but she hadn't realized it had expanded so far. And yet it wouldn't be the only thing that had grown rapidly when imaginative minds took what she'd taught them and ran with it. Right now, there were printing presses far superior to the primitive designs she'd introduced. Why not steam engines? How long had it taken Earth to move from the puffing devil to the flying Scotsman?
We were involved in some of the early investment, Marcus added. I took the liberty of adding some extra investment after the first track started to pay off.
Emily smiled. Did it repay its investors?
I believe so, Marcus said. Moving goods from Beneficence to Cockatrice is quicker now, thanks to the steam engines. But merely encouraging closer relations between the artisans in Cockatrice and the workers here has produced all sorts of interesting spin-offs. I believe that a number of new factories are being opened in Cockatrice, if only because we don't have the room for them. Some of the guildmasters were actually thinking of trying to buy land from you.
They'd have to talk to the king, Emily said. Cockatrice was entailed. She couldn't divide her lands amongst her children, let alone sell a small patch of ground to the highest bidder. Not without the king's permission, at least. It would be vulnerable, would it not?
I doubt that has escaped their mind, Marcus said dryly.
He pointed to the map.
If we surrender the protection of the river, who knows what King Randor will do?
Emily nodded in agreement. Beneficence was cut off from Zangaria by the Tribune River, a fast-flowing body of water that would be held to cross without modern technology or powerful magic. The four bridges linking Beneficence to the mainland could be blocked easily by the city guard if necessary. She had a feeling, from what she'd seen when she'd crossed the bridges with Lady Barb, that the bridges could be cut completely if there was a realistic chance they'd fall. There was definitely enough gunpowder in the powder mills to smash them beyond easy repair. But having territory on the wrong side would make it easier for Randor to strangle them, she thought. And the kings of Zangaria have conceded the city's permanent independence.
You could always colonize one of the smaller islands to the north, Emily mused. Zangaria doesn't have that much of a navy. You'd have no trouble smashing a blockade.
Perhaps, Marcus said.
But getting the trade goods to their destination might prove rather more difficult.
Trade-offs everywhere, Emily mused.
Marcus nodded. The real problem is that we don't have much of an international contract enforcement system, he said. Most merchant families are families, Emily, linked by ties of blood. They trust each other. That's always been a problem because it limits expansion. Either a family reaches its natural point and stops, or it starts making so many marriage alliances that they start to contradict each other.
He smiled.
You'll have discovered that yourself, I suppose.
Emily felt her cheeks heat. Does everyone take an interest in my life?
You're an interesting person, Marcus said with a wry smile.
Emily blushed harder. If she hadn't known Marcus was happily married, she would have taken his banter for flirting. Marcus smirked.
And given who you are, the person you marry is likely to be of considerable interest, too. Poor Caleb.
Emily sighed. People will talk, she muttered. They do nothing else.
If they're talking, Marcus countered, they're not plotting.
His secretary returned, carrying a sheet of paper in one hand. Marcus took it, scanned it with a practiced eye, and passed it back to her.
No, he said.
Yes, sir, his secretary said. Shall I have security escort him out?
Please, Marcus said.
He watched his secretary sashay out, then looked back at Emily.
I do think we will remain fairly stable, he said, but I don't like some of the rumors I'm hearing. Gods prowling the street, people being turned to stone. It's worrying.
Emily looked down at her hands. Do you believe in the gods? Marcus shrugged.
I've always believed in power, he said. Turning someone into a stone permanently isn't difficult with enough magic. Cloaking yourself in a godly seeming isn't difficult either. I could put together a spell to do it in a few hours if I had the time, and there is a suspicious uniformity to the confirmed cases that bothers me. I think we have a magic-using assassin, not a god. The rumors are just muddying the waters. And growing in the telling, Emily said. She suspected Marcus had a point. There were so many stories about her, she knew all too well, that some of the people who met her were disappointed. She hadn't crushed Shaedae with her bare hands, let alone seduced him into lowering his guard. There were probably more stories about Dua Kapala circulating now. "Are you watching your back?"
"I've taken a few precautions," Marcus said.
"There's an emergency tunnel I can use to get in or out of the bank, connected to a nearby house. I'll key you to the wards." He waved his hand. Emily felt the wards shifting around her, then resettling into the background. She couldn't help being impressed. It was a neat piece of spellwork.
"Officially, the house belongs to a sorceress called Robin," he said.
Emily couldn't help flinching. A sorcerer and demon master called Robin had tried to rape and enslave her nearly 1,000 years in the past.
"Unofficially, I own it. Just ask for the Robin house and people will direct you."
"Thank you," Emily said. Marcus rose.
"I hope to see you again before you leave," he said.
"Perhaps you and Caleb can join Melissa and me for dinner."
"Melissa would probably prefer to spend time with you," Emily said.
She rose. "But I'll see you soon." She walked back down the stairs and into the lobby. A pair of burly guards was escorting a pale-faced man out of the bank. His mouth opened and closed frantically, but no sound came out. Someone had clearly slapped a silencing spell on him, muting any protests. The customers looked amused rather than angry. Some of them even laughed. A man stepped in front of her.
"Lady Emily."
Emily blinked. That hadn't stayed a secret long, had it? She studied the man for a long moment. He was dark-skinned, probably around the same age as Sergeant Miles. His gold-rimmed spectacles helped him to project an air of reassuring competence. The gray robes he wore reminded her of school robes, but she couldn't sense any magic on him beyond a handful of protective charms. He looked more like a lawyer or another clerk than a magician.
"Yes," she said finally.
She carefully cast a privacy charm, trying to hold it in place without making it obvious.
"I am?"
The man bowed.
"I am Callum, son of Patrick."
His voice was artfully flat.
"Assistant to Tryon Vesperian. He requests the pleasure of your company."
Emily hesitated, glancing at her watch. She still had nearly an hour before she was due to meet Caleb and Frida, assuming she could find them. And she was curious. If nothing else, she wanted to know how her cover had been blown.
"Of course," she said. "It will be my pleasure."
Chapter 8 Emily was not surprised to discover that Vesperian's mansion was located in Starry Light, the richest part of the city. It was one of a dozen mansions, each surrounded by small gardens and protected by private guards. Their owners had gone to some trouble to try to make the buildings unique, placing statues of their ancestors or the gods outside their homes. Vesperian had placed a giant stylized V outside his mansion, just like the one she'd seen in the funicular. It glittered gold in the noonday sun. She tensed as she passed through the gates, silently readying a handful of protective spells. It hadn't occurred to her, until she'd already agreed to go, that it might well be a trap, although she knew no one in Beneficence who might want to do her harm. She certainly couldn't recall meeting Vesperian, even hearing of him, before she'd headed off to war. It was possible that he'd been one of the industrialists who'd flocked to Cockatrice as the new learning became more prevalent, but Byron and Perrin had been in charge of handling such matters. She'd chosen to keep her distance. "Which might have been a mistake," she told herself sternly. She reached out with her senses as they reached the door, which swung open as they approached. There were a handful of protective wards, one tuned to keep out supernatural vermin, the remainder aimed at anyone entering with bad intentions, but they didn't feel directly linked to a sorcerer.
Given time, she knew she, or any reasonably competent magician, could probably break into the house. The butler, wearing a long dark robe, bowed politely as Callum led her into the hallway. She couldn't help thinking that he lacked the loyalty and devotion she'd seen in some of King Randor's liegemen. Vesperian hadn't lived in the mansion long, she realized, as she looked around the hall. It looked as though he and his family had only moved in a year or so ago. The walls were lined with paintings and portraits, the former showing a combination of real steam locomotives and remarkable designs that wouldn't have been out of place in a steampunk universe. Some of the latter would take years to build, even assuming steam technology continued to advance. The remainder were probably doomed never to materialize, unless technology went in unprecedented directions. She couldn't help smiling as she followed Callum down the hallway. Vesperian, whatever else could be said about him, didn't lack imagination. But he did lack taste, she noted. Everything he'd placed on display showcased his wealth, golden statues clashing uncomfortably with old paintings and artifacts that dated all the way back to the pre-imperial days. There was no overall theme, none of the quiet elegance she'd seen in Whitehall or Queen Marlena's private chambers. The servants wore striking clothes, the men showing off their muscles, while the women displayed their breasts and legs. She couldn't help thinking Vesperian had designed everything to call attention to himself and his wealth. He was definitely nouveau riche. King Randor has to show off his power, she thought. She understood the logic, the need for the king to show off his power even when funds were running low, but she'd never cared for the style of King Randor's court. And Vesperian has to show off his wealth. She felt a twinge of pity mingled with amusement. Vesperian had no title, no long family history he could call upon to back up his claims. The older families in the city had probably sneered at him once upon a time. She wondered, as they stopped outside a large wooden door, if they were laughing at the parvenu now. A man who had purchased, or rented, a mansion in Starry Light could not be dismissed. The doors swung open.
"Lady Emily," Callum said. "Please allow me to introduce Tryon Vesperian."
Emily braced herself as she strode into the office. It was huge, easily larger than a small classroom at Whitehall. The walls were lined with bookcases, save for one wall dominated by a giant painting of Vesperian and his family. She sensed three more protective wards, one of which was definitely a supercharged privacy ward. The other two didn't seem to have any purpose, as far as she could tell. They were clearly designed to resist outside probing. She pulled back her awareness before she provoked a reaction. God alone knew what the wards were designed to do. Tryon Vesperian rose to his feet and bowed politely. He was tall, probably in his early 40s, but running to fat. His face was pale, but his almond eyes suggested that he too had some mixed blood in him. His hair was orange, a neatly trimmed goatee dominating his chin. It was a statement, Emily suspected. An unkempt beard would have suggested a nobleman, one dominated by his lower impulses. She'd seen too many of them at King Randor's court. Vesperian wore fine clothes, cut from the most expensive silk, a pair of black trousers, a white shirt, and a black waistcoat. That, too, was a statement, she suspected. Vesperian had come far in the world, far enough to afford such materials, yet he hadn't forgotten his humble beginnings. The shirt wasn't too different from what a common laborer would wear, but the silk would cost more than 1,000 laborers could earn in a year.
"Lady Emily," Vesperian said. His voice was polite, tinged with a hint of aristocracy. "I've wanted to meet you for a long time."
His handshake was firm, Emily discovered, as he shook her hand. It made her smile as he invited her to sit, summoning maids to bring food and drink. His manner suggested that he considered her an equal, perhaps more than an equal. She found it oddly refreshing. He wasn't bowing or scraping to her, or dismissing her, as some noblemen in Zangaria had tried to do. They'd never wanted to take women seriously. And yet there was something about his manner that set alarm bells ringing at the back of her mind.
"I've been following events in Cockatrice with great interest," Vesperian said, as a maid arrived with a tray of drinks and small cakes. "I'm glad to hear that most of your innovations remain in effect."
"They haven't been changed," Emily agreed. She couldn't help noticing that the maid's dress was terrifyingly short. I find they bring in considerably more tax revenue.
Of course, Vesperian said.
The maid withdrew, as silently as she'd come.
And they are spreading, are they not?
Swanhaven has adopted some of my innovations, Emily said. She covertly tested the drink and cakes for poison, finding nothing. I don't know how far they'll spread beyond there.
The new Baron has considerable influence, Vesperian said.
If he'd noticed her test, he didn't bother to comment on it.
And you know him, do you not?
Yes, Emily said flatly. King Randor had given Swanhaven to Jade, after both of the Baron's legal heirs had died. She couldn't decide if Randor had done his son-in-law a favor, or given him a poisoned chalice to drain. Swanhaven had been on the verge of outright rebellion only 7 months ago. He has many other duties to attend to. She nibbled one of the cakes, tasting sugar on her lips. It was sweet enough to make her teeth hurt, yet another display of wealth. Sugar was expensive, even in a trading city. The cake probably cost more than an entire month's supply of food for a poor family. She wasn't particularly impressed. There was a fine line between showing off one's wealth and naked, conspicuous consumption. Vesperian chatted about everything from politics to magic. Emily listened, feeling an odd sense of respect mingling with irritation. On one hand, he asked for her opinion and actually listened. On the other hand, he hadn't said anything of particular consequence, certainly nothing that explained why he'd asked her to visit. She could have had the same conversation with almost anyone, and yet somehow she doubted he just wanted a chat.
"The railway is coming along well," Vesperian said. "Have you ridden the line to Cockatrice?"
"Not yet," Emily said. Technically, she wasn't allowed to return to Zangaria without King Randor's permission. Practically speaking, Randor had no way to keep her out as long as she was careful, but it would put Alassa and Emeka in an awkward position if he found out, and Jade, who might be ordered to arrest her. "I hear it's spectacular, though."
"It is," Vesperian said.
He grinned. Oddly, she thought it was the first genuine emotion he'd shown.
"We started with a single track, which might have been a mistake. We had to add a second track within a month, just to run engines in both directions at once. Right now, we can move goods from Beneficence to Cockatrice City in just under 2 hours. We are currently working on extending the line further into Zangaria."
His smile grew wider. "My investors have been very happy," he added.
"Each individual payment is quite small, of course, but they've been mounting up rapidly. I've made them very wealthy men."
Emily nodded. "I'm sure they're pleased."
"They are," Vesperian said.
His smile lit up his face.
"And extending the line into Zangaria will bring them more money."
"One would hope so," Emily said. "Do you have permission to take the line further south?" Vesperian shrugged dismissively.
"There are some diplomatic headaches to be sorted out," he said, "and minor technical bugs."
Emily frowned.
"Diplomatic headaches?"
"A number of aristocrats are reluctant to allow us to take the railway through their territory unless we come to terms with them first." He sounded irked.
"Each of them holds out for the best deal he can get, but whenever one of their fellows gets a better deal, they want the same deal for themselves. They just don't stay bribed."
He shrugged.
"But we have enough agreements in place to extend the line into Swanhaven and up towards the Iron Hills," he added. "The profits will be considerable for those who cooperate."
Emily wasn't so sure. "Do either of them have anything to offer your investors?"
"The railway line will open up promising new investment opportunities," Vesperian said.
He rose and walked over to his desk, returning with a large paper map.
"Shipping iron ore, for example, has always been a problem. A working railway line will make it cheaper to ship ore around the country, as well as creating new markets for coal. The mines down south have never been fully developed."
He placed the map on the table, inviting Emily to inspect it. The map was practically a work of art, an order of magnitude more detailed than any of the rough maps she'd seen on campaign. She silently applauded the mapmaker, noting how he'd carefully sketched out the distances, instead of guessing wildly. It wouldn't be perfect, of course, but it was good enough to showcase Vesperian's plans. He'd even added the local boundary lines between the different noble estates. Her finger traced the railway lines on the map. The line between Beneficence and Cockatrice was relatively straight. It curved to avoid a couple of hills, but nothing else. The planned line beyond Cockatrice, however, looked as though someone had drawn a jagged line on the map. It swung around wildly, adding hundreds of miles to its final length. Some of the alterations made sense. There were places where building a bridge would be difficult, but others seemed to come out of nowhere. The planned track meandered at random. "This will add considerably to the final cost," she mused. "Why does it..." She tapped the line. It was strikingly inefficient.
"We've had problems getting permission to take the line through some of the estates," Vesperian reminded her. "In the long run, however, it will work in our favor. Clear proof of profit will convince the holdouts to join us, allowing us to expand the network through their territory. We'll be in a better position to dictate terms when we no longer need them."
Emily wasn't so sure. She'd met enough aristocrats to know they reacted badly to anything that threatened their power. The railway, in and of itself, wasn't much of a threat. It might even be profitable. But it would introduce a whole new world to the peasants laboring on the farms. Who knew what would happen when peasants could purchase a railway ticket to Beneficence? And never come back. It's hard enough catching runaways who flee to the nearest city, she thought grimly. She'd had to deal with hundreds of complaints from her neighbors the last time she'd been in Cockatrice. Too many of their peasants were fleeing into her territory. How much harder will it be if the runaways can cross the entire country? It wasn't the only problem, either. Building a line over relatively flat countryside was simple enough, but cutting through hills and mountains would be considerably harder. Vesperian would have to build bridges and stations, install crossings, everything necessary to run a railway line up to the Iron Hills, and there would be an ongoing demand for maintenance that would eat up the early profits. "It's an impressive scheme," she said. It wasn't a lie. It was impressive. But she doubted that profits would materialize as quickly as he suggested. "Why did you want to show it to me?" Vesperian leaned forward.
"I wanted to give you the opportunity to invest," he said confidently. "I can give you notes at a rate of 10 to 15.
Emily blinked. Marion had mentioned notes, hadn't she? But she hadn't gone into detail.
"You want me to invest?" she said slowly.
"Yes," Vesperian said. "Unfortunately, such a large project requires a sizable investment."
"It would," Emily agreed.
She listened as he outlined what he had in mind. Thankfully, listening to some of her tutors had taught her how to follow speakers who weaved backwards and forwards, sometimes changing the subject at random. It was simple enough, at least on first glance. She would invest 10,000 gold crowns, publicly, into Vesperian's track. In exchange, she would receive 15,000 crowns when the profit started rolling in. Vesperian himself wouldn't take any profit until his investors had been serviced. It sounded good. It sounded too good to be true. They might not be able to get the line built, she thought, looking down at the map. The line between Beneficence and Cockatrice served as a proof of concept, but it was also relatively simple. Scaling it up, even pushing the line to Swanhaven, would be expensive. And if they can't get permission to build the line, everything will be wasted. And yet she knew the railway line was necessary. "I will consider it," she said. "However, before I offer any money, I will require a good look at your accounting books." Vesperian's face froze just for a second.
"My books?"
"I need to know just how profitable the first part of the railway has been," Emily said. It seemed the obvious thing to check. "You do keep figures, don't you?"
"Of course I do," Vesperian said. "The line has been profitable, strikingly profitable."
"Then you should be willing to prove it," Emily thought. She looked back at him. "I am unwilling to invest any money until I know that the line is profitable," she said flatly. She wasn't Brian, or Ameka, but she knew a few things. "I will require a look at the accounting books, a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis for the future expansion, and a full list of your investment collateral." Vesperian's face darkened. "There are details I cannot share," he said. "My investors should have no objection to anything I demanded," Emily said. "Had Vesperian's original investors bothered to do any due diligence? I believe they would be interested in seeing the books, too." Vesperian rose firmly. "Thank you for coming, Lady Emily," he said. It was clearly a dismissal. "I may not be able to offer so good a deal in future." "I will not change my mind," Emily said. "I cannot even consider a loan before seeing your books." "As you wish," Vesperian said. He snapped his fingers. The door opened a moment later, revealing Callum. "My assistant will escort you back to your bank." "My bank?" Emily thought. She looked at him. "How did you know I was here? At the bank, I mean." Vesperian smiled. "That would be telling." Emily sighed. She'd announced herself to the clerk in front of two guards. Any of them could have tipped off Vesperian. They might not even be breaking their contracts with Marcus. Or perhaps someone had put two and two together and realized that she was staying with Caleb's family. It wouldn't be that hard to deduce her identity. Caleb and she hadn't made any sort of formal announcement, but the magical community probably knew they were dating. The thought made her more uncomfortable than she cared to admit. Her private life was none of their business. She nodded to Vesperian, catching a hint of something crossing his face. He hid it well, but he clearly hadn't been brought up in an aristocratic household. He was fearful or worried. Perhaps he has reason to worry, she thought. She followed Callum out of the house and through the streets. They seemed tenser somehow, although it was hard to put her finger on it. The crowds milled around, small groups forming only to break up moments later. She was missing something, she was sure. But what?
"Lady Emily," Callum said, breaking into her thoughts. "Where do you want to go?"
"Railway Street," Emily said. She was due to meet Caleb and Frida there. "I hear it's quite impressive."
"It is," Callum assured her. "I'll be happy to take you there. It's Mr. Vesperian's pride and joy."
Chapter 9 Railway Street was dominated, unsurprisingly, by a steam engine that was only 3 years old, but already outdated. The first steam engine was in Alexis, on display near Perrin's former workshop. This one, according to the placard underneath it, was the first steam locomotive to be designed in beneficence. It looked like a giant wooden kettle mounted on a wooden carriage. Emily suspected it had been outdated long before it had first been driven up the track, but building it had probably taught the local artisans a great deal about how to complete the job. She took a moment to admire the sight, then allowed her gaze to wander down the street. A dozen other steam engines stood there, all clearly wooden mock-ups, rather than real locomotives. Dozens of children clambered over them, waving to their friends and families as they posed on the tops or jumped down to the street. One of the engines, a little tank engine, had a large smiley face drawn on the front. The children seemed to find it delightful.
"Emily," a voice called.
She turned to see Caleb, hurrying over to her.
"Did you have a good time?"
"I had an odd invitation." Emily gave him a quick hug, then drew back. If Vesperian and Callum had identified her, who else might be watching? She'd have to use a glamour if she wanted to go out in public. "Where's Frida?"
"Just visiting the bookstalls," Caleb said. "I said I'd wait for you here."
Emily had to smile. Frida hadn't made a bad guess. Emily probably would have visited the bookstalls if Caleb hadn't found her first. Frida had certainly followed Emily through a dozen bookshops and stalls back in Dragon's Den. She took Caleb's hand and allowed him to lead her into a side street lined with small stalls. A dozen of them sold newly printed books. Beyond them, a broadsheet singer offered the latest broadsheets from three different printers. "There she is." Caleb nodded towards one of the larger stalls.
"Do you think you should be concerned about her reading matter?"
"Not as long as she doesn't take it back to Whitehall," Emily muttered as she saw a particularly lurid cover. "She'll be in trouble if someone catches her with it." She shook her head in annoyance as they walked over to join Frida. She'd introduced the printing press, knowing it would make books cheaper, yet she hadn't considered all of the ramifications.
Textbooks had become cheaper and more widely distributed, true, but the publishing industry had also boomed. Cheap novels had started to spring up all over the continent, including hundreds, perhaps thousands, of blue books. She supposed she shouldn't have been surprised by the growing mass of erotic fiction, almost all of it tame compared to some of the fan fiction she'd read, but it was still disconcerting. Blue books were banned at Whitehall, Mountaintop, and probably every other magical and mundane school in the world. Somehow, that hadn't put a dent in their popularity.
Emily!
Frida turned, holding a pair of books tucked under her arms. Emily decided it would be better to pretend she hadn't seen the cover. She doubted anyone's body could bend that way.
What happened at the bank?
I'll tell you over lunch, Emily said. Coming? Frida paid, then jerked a hand towards the furthest store.
You probably should take a look at that one, she said. There's stuff about Zangaria there.
Emily frowned. Stuff?
About King Randor, about Alassa, about everyone, Frida said. I glanced at a couple of pamphlets, Emily. They make Alassa out to be like one of the girls from Sapphic's Sorceress Sisters. She's having an affair with her handmaid as well as her husband.
She led Emily down the street and up to the stall before Emily could formulate a coherent response. The stall was covered in pamphlets and broadsheets, including a handful of hand-drawn cartoons. She glanced through a couple, then shook her head in disgust. Alassa wasn't the only one being slandered, depending on the writer. King Randor, Baroness Harkness, and Baron Gaunt were accused of all sorts of perversions, while Sir Roger of the Greenwood had apparently been partying in Farrakhan during the war. That, at least, she knew to be a lie. He and his men had played a major role in saving the city from the first enemy attack. "They've been fighting the Battle of the Broadsheets for a long time," Caleb said quietly. "I don't think anyone's managed to ban them from the city." Emily nodded reluctantly. Journalism in Zangaria, and the rest of the world, was still in its infancy. Truth and justice took a back seat to sensation and titillation. King Randor had probably banned most of these broadsheets. She could pick out a couple of familiar names, but he'd find it impossible to keep them out of his kingdom completely. The printers could pay a couple of kids to distribute them, then pull up stakes and vanish. They'd never be caught. "I'll have to discuss it with Alassa," she said. She suspected it would be pointless. Alassa couldn't do anything about it either. But it probably needed to be mentioned. The tensions in Zangaria continued to rise from what she'd heard. Slanderous suggestions about the Crown Princess's personal life would only undermine her position when she took the throne. "Do you want to pick a place for lunch?" Frida nodded and led the way back to Railway Street. Emily followed, holding Caleb's hand and thinking hard. Were there stories about her on the stall? It was hard to imagine anything worse than the songs she'd heard shortly after defeating Shaedae, but she knew her imagination in such matters was limited. The bards had come up with all sorts of explanations for her victory, ranging from the possible to the outrageous. And there was nothing she could do about that, either. "Burgers," Caleb said, as Frida pointed to the eatery. "Coming?" Emily sighed, dismissing her concerns. "Yeah," she said. "Can you get us a private booth?" She followed them into the burger bar, looking around with interest. It could have passed for a fast-food restaurant on Earth if the chairs and tables hadn't been wooden and the burgers larger and generally more attractive. She reminded herself to be careful what she put on her burger as a waitress led them to a private booth. The local mustard was far stronger than the yellow crap she'd eaten back home. "So," Caleb said, once they were seated and orders had been placed, "what happened?" Emily ran her hand through her hair. "I've been noticed," she said. She cast a privacy ward before continuing. "Vesperian himself asked me to visit." Caleb blinked.
"And you went alone? Without telling us where you were going?"
"I beat a necromancer," Emily reminded him. She knew he had a point, but that didn't stop his concern being irritating. "And I didn't know where to find you."
"Ouch,"
Frida said. She shrugged.
"What did he want?"
"Alone." Emily went through the full story as they waited for the burgers. "He wanted 10,000 crowns." Caleb muttered a rude word under his breath. Emily didn't blame him. The value of money on the Nameless World was a little variable, largely because coinage hadn't been standardized for long, but 10,000 crowns was an immense sum. She had a feeling it was well over $10 million, perhaps much more. Even a well-paid alchemist would be lucky if he made over 100 crowns in a year. Frida shook her head.
Do you have that sort of money?
Emily winced inwardly. She'd never liked discussing money. He thinks I do, she said finally. Vesperian might well be right. Even if she didn't have 10,000 crowns at hand, she could, presumably, use her position as Baroness Cockatrice to take out a loan. Hell, Imeka would probably send the money if Emily asked for it. But I asked him for a look at his books, and he refused. Caleb's eyes narrowed.
That's probably not a good thing.
Frida glanced at him.
Probably?
On one hand, opening his books would help to convince someone to offer him a loan, Caleb pointed out. But on the other, it would also reveal the names of his investors, who could then be targeted if someone wanted to ruin his business. The Accountants Guild was noted for using their inside information to cause trouble, back before the new learning. Emily nodded slowly.
If he wants so much money, that's probably not a good thing either.
Caleb leaned forward. Do you remember what Marion said yesterday? She was talking about notes, Emily recalled. A thought struck her. Vesperian offered me 15 for 10. Caleb met her eyes.
You wouldn't be the first person to be offered such a good deal, he said.
The price of notes has been going up and up, and it will come down, Emily finished. Frida held up a hand.
Notes?
Emily and Caleb exchanged glances.
Vesperian has been selling promissory notes to everyone with the money to buy them, he said. He started out by offering 11 for 10, from what I heard, but the rate has been going up over the last few months. People have even been exchanging the notes or selling them on.
Shares, Emily muttered. She shook her head in disbelief. Sounded like a recipe for trouble.
I don't understand, Frida said. What does it mean?
Suppose I loan you 10 crowns, Emily said. We set the repayment rate at 15 to 10 with a due date of, well, next month. You have to pay me 15 crowns, and if you don't, I have the right to claim something of yours.
I don't think I have anything that's worth 15 crowns, Frida mused.
You're a poor investment risk, Caleb jibed. Emily ignored him. We write the terms of the loan down in a promissory note, she added carefully. I could then sell that note onwards to Caleb for 11 crowns, perhaps. Caleb then makes a profit of 4 crowns when you pay him the full 15.
Except you would have given up a profit of 4 crowns, Frida said slowly. Why would you do that?
I might need the money before the note came due, Emily said. You wouldn't be paying out the full amount before then.
Assuming you can pay, Caleb pointed out.
He sounded disturbed. What happens if you can't pay? What happens if you don't have anything to cover the cost? The burgers arrived before Emily could think of an answer. They were huge, cooked to perfection, and slathered with melting hunks of cheese. The server brought them a small collection of condiments and a basket of oversized chips, then hurried away again. Emily reminded herself, again, to be careful with the sauces. They were nothing like the ones she'd used at home. Healthier, though, she thought. But we might have to skip dinner.
I don't know what would happen if someone couldn't repay the loan, she said slowly.
She tested the burger, just to make sure it was safe to eat. If they didn't have anything that could be seized, they'd be in some trouble. Caleb picked up his burger and took a careful bite, then a larger one.
10,000 crowns. How many of his bills are coming due?
Emily winced. If she was right, and she had no reason to think otherwise, Vesperian was borrowing money to repay the first set of loans, rather than investing it in his railway. 10,000 crowns could repay a lot of debts, as well as convincing some of his creditors that there was no need to panic and demand repayment. He might even be able to use the sudden influx of money to get more loans. But the wheels will fall off sooner or later, she thought. Vesperian and his investors were playing musical chairs for high stakes. When the music stops, and it will,
Who's left out in the cold? She'd seen it happen back on Earth. Someone took out a loan, then another loan, then struggled to repay the interest, sinking further and further all the time. She'd known people who had been so deeply in debt that they hadn't had a hope in hell of escaping. And they'd dealt with relatively small sums of money, hardly noticeable to the banks and credit card companies. What would happen if a giant corporation went the same way? It would be a nightmare. I don't know, she said. And without further information, I'm not going to invest. Mother banned Karen and Marion from investing, Caleb said. She told them they weren't allowed to use any of their allowance to invest. I don't blame her, Emily said. Karen and Marion would be annoyed, she was sure, but she suspected their mother was right to be wary. There was no way either of the girls would be counted amongst the major creditors once the hammer fell. How did they take it?
Poorly, Caleb said.
His face twisted. Their friends are bragging about scoring good deals, and they're out in the cold. They might have the last laugh. Frida dunked a chip into something that smelled like Tabasco, then nibbled it thoughtfully. What happens if their friends don't get their money back? Emily shrugged. A school child's allowance was nothing in the grand scheme of things. A handful of cents wouldn't amount to much. The teenagers would be embarrassed and humiliated, but there wouldn't be any major consequences beyond annoyed parents, would there? She found it hard to believe that anyone in beneficence would give their children that much pocket money. They'll be laughing, Caleb predicted, and their friends will be hurt. We should investigate. Frida looked up, interested. How far can this possibly go? Emily considered it carefully. She'd read about financial bubbles, but most of the details had slipped her mind. Even a relatively low-tech society could have a sudden upswing in share prices, followed by an equally rapid crash when the shareholders realized their mistake and tried to withdraw their money before it was too late. What would happen if investors realized Vesperian couldn't repay them? It would be bad, she thought numbly. I don't know, she said finally. It would depend on too many factors. She forced herself to think. How much did Vesperian actually own? His mansion. Did he own it? If he was renting the building, there was no way he could sell it to recoup his losses and repay his investors. The railway and its rolling stock, or what else did he have? She didn't know, but she did know that the only people who came out ahead in a pyramid scheme were the ones right at the very top. Don't invest, she said. Frida laughed. Good advice, Caleb said. I just hope my sisters listened. He paused. I hope Casper listened, he added after a moment. He was certainly old enough to make his own decisions. I don't think he would have had enough money to make a difference. Emily took another bite of her burger, enjoying the taste. Did Master Grave give him an allowance?
I don't know, Caleb said.
He grinned.
Did Sergeant Miles give you an allowance?
Emily shook her head. It had never occurred to her to ask for one. She'd taken enough cash with her to meet all her personal needs, given that the army supplied the sorcerers and their apprentices with food, bedding, and everything else they needed, and she'd never been one to gamble. It wasn't as if the other apprentices had invited her to any high-stakes games. He could have asked our parents for an advance on his inheritance, Caleb mused, but I don't think they would have agreed. Probably not, Emily said. How would that have worked?
Poorly, Caleb said. He was the heir, after all.
Emily met his eyes. What did your mother say to you?
Nothing I can talk about here.
He shot Frida a glance.
But we do have to talk.
I'm sure I can trust you to behave, Frida said.
She glanced from Emily to Caleb, then looked at her watch.
There's a train due in 30 minutes. I can wander off afterwards, leaving you two alone.
Thank you, Emily said. She knew Frida meant well, but her constant supervision was annoying. We won't do anything stupid.
Vesperian must be getting desperate, Caleb mused as he finished his burger. I would have expected him to send you a formal invitation to dinner, not have one of his flunkies accost you outside a bank. It smacks of something put together on the spur of the moment, rather than a carefully thought-out plan.
Emily nodded. She hadn't thought about it like that, but Caleb was right.
By any reasonable standard, Vesperian should have wined and dined her before requesting a loan, and perhaps put together a better case. It sounded more like he'd taken advantage of an unexpected opportunity, rather than planning everything down to the last detail. Frida had a different thought.
Did he really expect you to write him a bank draft?